Institute here in lovely Auburn, Alabama. It's the largest, apparently the largest Mises University ever this year. I think there's about 250 attendees, and it's really a great environment. Oh, Grayson is reminding me I forgot to start recording. Okay, now we're recording. As I said before, we're here to talk about the role of government and the state in business organization, how the state affects the entrepreneur, how the state affects business. I noticed, actually, as I was preparing for our discussion today, that when I laid out the course at the beginning of, you know, before we started, I titled this week's discussion the corporation and the state. I think, in retrospect, that wasn't the best name. I really want to talk not only about the corporation, but more generally about the relationship between the state and the entrepreneur and the business firm. Corporate issues will be very important in that, but we're not only going to talk about things affecting corporations. I see we have quite a few people with us today. First, let me apologize for the schedule change. As you know, we're starting 30 minutes later than we usually start because I had a lecture at the Mises University that just let out, just ended about a half hour ago, and students always want to stick around and ask questions during the break, so I had to hurry on up here to another room at the Mises Institute to give the lecture. So it's been a fun and exhausting week for me already, and it's only day two of Mises University, but I'm glad to be back in familiar surroundings with you guys, my colleagues and my friends, to talk more about the entrepreneur and the firm. It's true, Dan, yes, this room is not nearly as nice as the other room. I have no pictures of Mises or Rothbard or Bombavik behind me, but of course I do get the halo, which is nice. Also, this room is a little bit quieter, and the air conditioning is much better, so it's very cool and comfortable here. The other room tended to get a little hot, and the internet connection was a little spottier in that other room, so I think I'll probably be here for office hours on Thursday as well. We will have office hours at the usual time, 10 o'clock and 10 a.m. Eastern time on Thursday, because I don't have any other talks that are scheduled. Dan mentioned that he's listening to somebody else. I guess there's a live stream of all the Mises University lectures. And so in another window on your computer, you could be watching or listening to some Woods guy. I don't know who he is or why they invited him. But if you want to listen to him instead, you could do that. I guess you could watch me later by listening to the recording. But hey, let's be here. Let's do this in real time. It's more fun. The fact that I'm wearing a coat and tie, Dean, has absolutely nothing to do with the requirement of the Mises University administrators that speakers be appropriately dressed for the plenary lectures. As to what I'm wearing, below the waist, hey, it's like the old question of what a Scotsman wears under his kilt. You just have to use your imagination. So, what we have in store for today. Oh, by the way, this is the next to the last week, right? So this week we have, I have some slides and a little bit of, some assigned readings and so on, like a sort of a formal class period. Next week is really just kind of an open-ended review time. So we have a lecture scheduled in the usual lecture time for next week. And I'll give a short lecture. I want to make some kind of summary remarks, looking back on everything we've covered throughout the course. I want to try to tie things together, and leave you with some takeaways that hopefully you can use in your future study, future work, future research, and so on. But we won't have a full, 90-minute lecture and Q&A kind of time, and I don't have any new readings on assignment for next week. It's rather a review of the readings that we've already done. So I guess the point I'm making is, as a tear rolls down my cheek, that we're near the end here. But without sounding too cheesy, I hope that next week's class won't be just the end, but it will rather be the beginning of a long and beautiful relationship. Not necessarily between you and me, although that'd be nice too, but a relationship between you and the subject matter of our course. Also, we may have an opportunity, I hope that I'll have an opportunity to do other Mises Academy courses in the future. And so, as I've said earlier this semester, if you have some ideas for topics or issues, readings, and so on that you would like to address in a future Mises Academy course, whether I'm the teacher or not, I hope that you'll pass those suggestions on to Jeff Tucker and to others in the administration, because we're just getting this Academy thing off the ground, and I'm hoping that it will grow and expand, and we should have lots of opportunities to build it into a full, a real Academy, a competitor to established universities. So anything that you're interested in studying and are willing to pay a modest fee to study, I think, can be worked into some kind of a course or some kind of a program. Yes, you're right. We are a real Academy, Daniel. What I meant to say is something that has the same kind of scope or range of offerings that established universities have. Of course, we wouldn't want to duplicate what they're doing because they're all losers. We want to do something better. We want to do our own thing. But I think we can have a lot more things that we can offer in the future. So, anyway, our subject for today is government and the entrepreneur and the firm, the corporation and the state, as I titled it on the syllabus. And notice that there are some required readings and then an optional reading as well. The required readings are all pretty short. I hope you've had a chance to look at them already. If not, take a look as soon as you can. There's a little encyclopedia piece on regulation by Robert Lighton that I think is very useful. And then a piece by Bruce Yandel summarizing his famous bootleggers and Baptist theory. Excuse me. This 1999 piece from Yandel is not the first piece in which he offered this bootleggers and Baptist argument, but it provides a nice concise summary with some applications that I think it's very insightful. I also linked to one of my blog posts on organizations and markets, and then also this exchange between Roderick Long and myself. Poor Roderick is still recovering from the wounds that I inflicted on him, when I wiped him, off the floor. But at least that's how I see it. He may not see it exactly that same way. I also included an article, a recent article of mine with some co-authors on so-called public entrepreneurship, which is a little bit outside the scope of our discussion today, and I just put it on there as an optional reading, so look at it if you're interested, but don't if you're not. It gives some suggestions about how we might apply some of the concepts we've developed this semester to non-market settings, thinking about government officials and non-profit agencies and so on, how they act in the manner of capitalist entrepreneurs, even though they are not, strictly speaking, capitalist entrepreneurs, because they are operating outside of the price mechanism. There are some slides for today, and you can see that they're already on the course page in PDF form. If you want to look at them there, or you can just look at them on my screen. I'm about to put them up and to share my desktop. So give me just a second to do that. May take a moment. It says it's taking a little bit longer than a moment, but okay, great. Now hopefully you can see my screen, and I'm going to put up some PowerPoints here. Which you cannot see. Aha! Okay, here we go. Okay, so you should be able to see the PowerPoint slides now. Anybody having problems with the slides? Okay. Okay, the corporation and the state. What, you know, I mean, this is a lot of material to cover, right? I mean, we could have an entire course on business-government interactions, and we probably should have a course devoted to that, or multiple courses. It's obviously a huge subject, and what I want to do today is just offer a brief overview of, with a focus on a few particular topics that often come up in discussions among Austrian scholars on entrepreneurship and capitalism. You know, regulatory economics or the economics of government action and intervention is obviously a huge subject. You know, a lot of different ways that we can sort of slice and dice the material and say, well, government, maybe we can classify government intervention into different groups, different categories like income distribution, right? So anti-poverty programs, welfare programs, food stamps, and so on. Progressive income taxation, right? These are all attempts to sort of shuffle resources around to take money away from some and give money to others. That's one category of government intervention into the economy. There's the whole category of health and safety regulation, including the Food and Drug Administration, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, OSHA. These are obviously the U.S. These are U.S. agencies, but those of you coming from other countries, you have the same people in your you have the same thing in your country. It's like the famous joke about the visiting dignitary who comes to the U.S. and when someone meets him at the airport, the visiting dignitary asks, "Well, could you give a summary of what's the political system in your country?" And the local official says, "Well, we have two parties. We have the evil party and the stupid party." And the foreign visitor says, "Oh yeah, of course, that's the same two parties we have in our country, right? Now, which parties you consider to be evil and which parties you consider to be merely stupid depends on your own point of view." But again, when I use U.S. examples of particular regulatory agencies or whatever, it's the same thing wherever you're coming from. But there's another category of economic interventions that you might call more narrowly sort of economic efficiency, the policies related to the efficient allocation of resources. And maybe we could divide those further into sort of macro and micro categories, right? So, monetary and fiscal policy designed to quote unquote stabilize the economy would be one category, but then antitrust, business regulation, competition policy, as it's normally called, would be examples of microeconomic interventions. Micro, of course, not meaning small in their effects, but rather policies that are designed to apply to specific industries or specific firms and not to the economy as a whole. And now, looking more narrowly at business regulation or commercial regulation, again, there are a number of different areas, each of which, maybe deserves an entire course. There's the whole area of so-called competition policy. So regulating businesses, what prices they can charge, what products they can produce, how large they can be, whether they can combine with other firms or not, what procedures they have to use to bring their products to market. And if you add antitrust policy to that as well, you have a whole set of government actions that govern what firms are allowed to do. In a sense, sort of the legal environment, the more general kind of legal regime, can be considered a part of business regulation, though it isn't always classified in that way. Are you in an environment, sort of in one of the common law countries, in which common law rules and legal procedures govern economic activity, as opposed to a civil law country with a civil law system or civil law origin? In fact, there's a whole stream of research that has become very popular in the last 10 years or so, looking at different countries and trying to categorize the legal system or the legal environment in different ways. Common law, civil law, centralized, decentralized, independent judiciary, judiciary that's, you know, that's not independent of the legislature and so on. So there are a number of different ways that we might characterize the property rights regime, how the legal process works and so on. And those are, of course, part of the institutional environment in which business is conducted. And characteristics of the legal regime, of the legal environment, certainly affect the firm, affect the entrepreneur, affect the capitalist process. If you like, we could classify what we could think of macro policy as a kind of business regulation. We don't normally think of it that way. We think of monetary and fiscal policy, just affecting sort of aggregate variables, GDP and the unemployment rate and so on. But macroeconomic policy is certainly part of the individual entrepreneur's institutional or regulatory legal environment, right? Is the monetary authority pursuing a loose or a tight policy with regard to credit expansion? Is the economy, macroeconomy, highly volatile, subject to a lot of cyclical, or what appear to be cyclical disturbances? Right, so a lot of this is industry specific. The tech sector in the 90s, the real estate sector in the last decade, and so on. Capitalist entrepreneurs operating in those particular sectors have to be particularly cognizant of what the monetary authorities and so on are doing. Maybe for particular industries, policy toward international trade, international fiscal and monetary policy, tariffs and quotas, subsidies, trade protection, and so on, export subsidies, etc., exchange rate policy. Those are all part of the business environment as well. So my point is, these are all things that business people, that capitalist entrepreneurs need to understand and be sensitive to and operate within, right? Capitalist entrepreneurs are constrained by these different aspects of business regulation and need to understand them and understand their effects. Now, why do we have business regulation? Why regulate the economy? Why place legal restrictions on what capitalist entrepreneurs can do? Well, there are two different sort of families of explanation. Call them public interest and private interest explanations. The public interest rationales for regulation are the ones that are in most elementary textbooks, the ones that are taught to kids in elementary school and high school. I think of this as kind of the high school civics text, explanation for regulation. Namely, that the government has to intervene in the economy to make things better, right? To do for people what they can't do for themselves, to control the excesses of business, to make business people work in the interests of consumers rather than against consumers, and that sort of thing. I mean, as you can tell by my tone of voice, I'm not particularly sympathetic to these kinds of rationales, but I certainly recognize them as ones that are commonly taught. Right? If we want to discuss them in slightly more technical terminology, we might put them in categories like defining and enforcing property rights. So many people would argue that one important role of the government or the state is to determine who gets to own what and what are the limits of ownership of particular resources or activities and so on. How should land be divided up? Who gets to own what land? If you dig stuff out of the ground, do you get full ownership of it? Or as many people like to say, do the natural resources belong to all the people? Or can they be commonly owned? Can you own air? Can you own oceans and rivers or not? Well, these are things that the legal system, that are determined by legal rules. And some people would argue that the state, the legislature, the executive, the courts have a very important role to play in defining and enforcing property rights. Hotly debated issue in recent years among libertarian scholars has been the whole concept of intellectual property. Patent and copyright law, for example, trademark law, and so on. There's no doubt that that inventors, that people in the creative arts, writers, authors, movie producers, songwriters, and so on, that they are producing valuable things, right? But to what extent can they have exclusive ownership over those things? Should the state grant exclusive privilege, a monopoly privilege, to somebody who invents a particular technology and gets it patented? Or a songwriter who comes up with a particular combination of notes, particular sequence of notes, or a writer who comes up with a particular sequence of words? Should those things be legally protected as property? What are the limits to that legal protection? And there's lots and lots of literature on IP that I think is extremely interesting and informative. Wherever you stand on that particular issue, the point here is that many scholars would argue, well, of course you need the government to define property and to enforce property rights. Right? The counter-argument, of course, would be that private voluntary market institutions can also perform the role of defining and enforcing property rights. But the more standard or conventional understanding among scholars in a number of fields is that this is a natural and appropriate role for the state. Among mainstream economists, there's a big literature on what is called market failure, things like externalities, external benefits and external costs, so-called public goods, the problem of monopoly, and so on, that these are inefficiencies in the market, failures of the free market relative to some hypothetical ideal of perfection that the government needs to step in and redress. Okay? Now, there's a whole literature in mainstream economics and many important contributions by Austrian economists to the theory and implications of so-called market failure. Right? So, one issue is, how do you define these things? What is an externality? What is a public good? How do you know one if you see one? Right? Is it even theoretically possible to define these things in a way that they could be addressed through government action if such a thing were desirable? Second issue relates to implementation, right? So even if a real world market outcome fell short by some standard, fell short in some way relative to some kind of hypothetical ideal, the textbook model of perfect competition, for example. Even if that were true, would it be possible to set up a government agency to empower the state in some way, to impose some kind of solution, to make this better in some way? Many economists, not necessarily Austrian economists, but including Austrians, have written about the problem of government failure. Even if we accepted the notion of market failure, would empowering the government to try to make firms lower their prices or make firms account for externalities or have the government produce so-called public goods, would that be an improvement given the inefficiencies, the corruption, and so on that we know is associated with government action? Another purported rationale is that wealth redistribution, as I mentioned before, taking money from some people and giving it to others. Now, you might think that that's purely some kind of ethical or normative issue that doesn't have anything to do with economics, but it's true historically. Many economists have used the concept of diminishing marginal utility as a justification for progressive income taxation. Now, I think this is a misunderstanding of diminishing marginal utility in the Austrian sense, in Karl Menger's sense, because Menger's notion of diminishing marginal utility applies strictly to individuals. So a given individual values the fifth unit of a homogeneous good less than he values the fourth unit, because he allocates that fifth unit to a lower valued use than the use to which he allocated the fourth unit. It has nothing to do with the value of a marginal unit of a good or service to one person as opposed to another person, right? A lot of people think that diminishing marginal utility means, a marginal dollar is worth less to a rich man than a poor man, has a lower marginal utility for Bill Gates than it does, for Peter Klein. Therefore, the government can increase aggregate utility by taking dollars away from Bill Gates and giving them to Peter Klein. I mean, I personally would be all in favor of such a policy, but I don't think one can appropriately this doesn't increase social utility in some way, whatever that means, okay? But when you talk to people about, you know, why we should have, why do they think we ought to have economic regulation, this is the kind of thing that, you know, you learn in a high school civics text. Well, the government has to protect property rights, and also the government has to fix market failures, and then the government has to make sure the wealth is evenly distributed or whatever. Now, you know, many of you are probably thinking, gee, that sounds a little naive, okay? And it certainly does sound pretty naive in my view, right? An alternative, you know, again, purely sort of positive explanation for why we have regulation in general and why we have particular kinds of economic regulation is that they serve somebody's private interest. That there are special interest groups that benefit from particular kinds of rules and policies and work hard to get those rules put into place, right? I mean, you might think of the policymakers themselves who get money or prestige, status, utility in some sense from regulating. You know, it's fun to do that kind of thing. You know, as many of you guys know, I'm a big fan of despair.com, the people who put out the Demotivators series. I've used several of these in my lecture. You saw in my lectures, you saw the one on government on the previous slide. The one they have on power, it's hilarious. The caption says, quoting Lord Acton's famous dictum, right? It says, you know, power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but it also rocks absolutely. That's the tagline for that particular demotivator, meaning a lot of people think it's fun to have power. That would be a private interest rationale for some rule, right? Some government agent is getting his jollies from telling business people what to do and passing a bunch of laws and fining people or whatever. That could be part of it. Right, but there could also be business interests that benefit from particular rules and policies. In fact, economists have developed a pretty sophisticated understanding of how regulation benefits particular private interests, what's sometimes called the economic theory of regulation, associated more with the Chicago school, people like George Stigler, Milton Friedman, and then with the Austrian school, says that we can theorize about regulation by thinking of it as a good or service that's traded in a market. In other words, there's a demand for regulation. Certain special interest groups benefit from having particular regulations. And there's a supply of regulation. There are politicians and judges and so on who benefit in various ways from supplying particular kinds of rules. And it's this interplay between demand and supply that explains what regulations we get, when we get them, what they do, and so on. Okay, an important insight in the private interest approach to regulation is the notion that we're much more likely to see particular rules when the beneficiaries represent a concentrated group, and those who are harmed by the regulation are sort of an amorphous, not very well-defined group. In other words, we ought to look for regulations that have concentrated benefits and dispersed costs to try to predict or explain what regulations we have. Right? It's very easy to see that in the case of, oh, say, a steel tariff. Okay? So who benefits from a tariff on imported steel? Well, steel producers in the home country. So in the U.S., for example, if U.S. steelmakers can lobby Congress to put very high tariffs on imported steel from Asia, let's say, that allows domestic steel producers to charge higher prices than they otherwise would. You know, it shuts out a potential set of competitors, and it allows domestic steel producers to earn higher profits than they otherwise would. So if you're a steel producer, a shareholder in a steel producing company, a worker who works in the steel industry, it's obvious how you would benefit from having a high steel tariff. Who is harmed by a tariff on imported steel? Well, foreign steel producers are harmed, but they have only a limited ability to affect domestic legislation, right? The main domestic, the people in the home country who are harmed by the steel tariff are users of steel, consumers of steel, either directly or indirectly, in the products that all the products that use steel. Well, who is that? Well, that's basically everybody, right? Everyone in the home country who consumes products that use steel is harmed by the tariff, in the sense that steel prices are higher than they otherwise would be, and the prices of goods and services that use steel are higher than they otherwise would be. But the key point is, how much higher? Right? In the U.S., let's say we have, 250 million consumers, right, all of whom are buying products that use steel. Well, the steel industry gets a lot more money from the steel tariff, and so the prices of goods and services that use steel are higher, but maybe only a little bit higher, because you spread out that those higher costs over 250 million people. So each of us pays a few pennies more for a pen that has some steel in it. Each of us pays a few dollars more for our cars because they have steel in them. And any products that use steel, houses and so on, we pay a little bit more than we otherwise would. But maybe it's not a lot. Maybe we don't notice it, right? We know that cars are a little bit more expensive than they were last year, but we don't know whether it's because of higher steel prices or something entirely different, right? So we don't notice, and we don't have a very strong incentive to sort of lobby against the steel tariff. I mean, again, the benefits of the steel tariff are concentrated among a pretty well-defined group, the steel industry. And members of the steel industry have a strong incentive to go to Congress and lobby to have the steel tariff passed. Whereas steel consumers, well, that's basically everybody in the economy. It's not a well-defined or well-organized group that has nearly as much on the table as do members of the steel industry. So we steel consumers don't organize. We don't have an interest group, the Associated Union of Steel Using People, with 250 million members. So we don't organize and we don't go lobby Congress. So therefore, the steel tariff is much more likely to get passed than some other rule, some other law that benefits, everybody, right? So getting the steel tariff repealed benefits a very diverse group, and it imposes costs on a well-defined group. So we're going to see a lot of organized resistance, okay? Related to this is Bruce Yandel's, fabulous metaphor of the bootleggers and Baptists, right? And if you read the article, you understand where the name comes from. It's great name, right? The general bootlegger and Baptist idea is that we often find these sort of odd coalitions of seemingly unrelated groups that work together either explicitly or implicitly to get certain rules passed, right? So the laws against selling liquor, the beneficiaries are bootleggers, people who make a living from the illegality of alcohol, people with a dollar interest, an economic interest in liquor being illegal, and the quote-unquote Baptists, meaning people who make sort of a moral case against, in the prohibition example, against liquor consumption. So the idea is you have both bootleggers and Baptists who don't know each other and don't like each other, don't want to have anything to do with each other, both working, in a sense, hand in hand to get, alcohol declared to be illegal. Yandel, in the article I asked you to read, is talking about environmental issues, right? So think about, laws that restrict industrial pollution. And Yandel talks a little bit about the Clean Air Act back in the 1970s, right? Well, to use that specific example in the U.S., the Clean Air Act, which restricted industrial pollution, applied only to new construction, right? So factories, plants, and so on built after the passage of the Act had to meet these particular environmental restrictions, but existing plants were grandfathered in, okay? Now, who stands to benefit from a rule like that? Well, the so-called Baptist group in that example would be environmentalists, the Sierra Club, people who are in favor of, the greeny types, the tree huggers, okay, who say, yeah, pollution is bad and we need to stamp it out, we need to have these tough rules on factories, blah, blah, blah. But also, you have a so-called bootlegger group, right? You have owners of existing factories who benefit from the law because it imposes costs on their competitors. It helps to keep out new entrants, right? We see the same thing in many, many examples. The U.S. had something called the Americans with Disabilities Act in the back in the early 1990s that required firms to make accommodations for people with disabilities, larger bathroom stalls and elevators and ramps for people who couldn't climb stairs, people in wheelchairs, and so on. Now, again, the Baptist interest, the so-called Baptist group, is people who are advocates for the disabled. It's not fair that people in wheelchairs can't get into certain buildings. To be fair, we need to make sure that they have a way to get in, and they have specially designated parking spaces and so on. Right? Who are the bootleggers in that case? Well, notice that rules that say you have to have certain kind of bathrooms and certain kind of ramps and certain kind of parking and so on, those rules are much easier for large enterprises to conform to than small enterprises. Right? Big companies already had those things anyway. It was smaller firms that didn't have those accommodations and that found it very difficult to make those accommodations. So we saw with the Americans with Disabilities Act, the lobby groups that represented big companies very aggressively lobbying for the act, and lobby groups representing smaller enterprises lobbying against it. Right? It isn't that big companies are more caring somehow than smaller companies. It's that the big companies saw this as a way to impose higher costs on their rivals. And naturally, they were in favor of these kind of rules. Okay. What are some specific insights that come out of thinking about this sort of supply and demand for regulation, the so-called economic theory? The idea is that various special interest groups demand particular kinds of rules, both for Baptist type reasons and for bootlegger type reasons, as we've already discussed. But then you have politicians or political actors who are willing to supply policies, rules, regulations to meet that demand. A typical textbook definition of politicians in this context would be self-interested individuals seeking to enrich themselves, either monetarily or otherwise, by supplying legislation that benefits some group. So one of the attractive features of the economic approach to regulation is that it models politicians just like everybody else. They're not a kind of, it's not a kind of sainthood. Politicians are not these benevolent dictators, Platonic philosopher kings who just want to, correct market failure or whatever. No, I mean, they're people just like you and me who want to get certain things, and they want to use whatever means they can to get the things that they want. Maybe it's getting reelected, maybe it's getting campaign contributions, maybe it's getting it's exercising power. Who knows? The point is, politicians are self-interested, utility-maximizing individuals just like everybody else. So you have demand, you have supply, you put it together, and you have some kind of a market for regulation or legislation. Not exactly the same as a market for shoes or the market for tomatoes, but it has some common features. Let me give you just one example that I've sometimes used in my regular classes to illustrate how this market might work. Think about a regulated monopoly, like an electric company. Think about a city or a town that has a single monopoly provider of electricity. It's a private company, let's assume, but it's regulated, its prices are controlled by some kind of regulatory authority. This is, of course, the common setup in most cities and towns in the developed world. So you have this power company. It's been given a legal monopoly privilege by the regulatory agency, but the regulatory agency gets to set the price, orders the monopolist to charge a particular price for electricity, or maybe it's water or garbage or whatever the service that's being provided might be. What are the interests of different groups in this example? Well, the regulated monopoly, the power company, wants to maximize its profit, right? consumers, the people who pay for electricity, and that's not only residential consumers, but industrial consumers as well, you know, they want lower prices. They want electricity to be cheap. Now, both of these groups can offer some political support to the regulator, the rate-setting board, right? The industry, the electric company can offer perks and privileges and campaign contributions and lucrative speaking engagements or whatever for the regulator. Consumers can offer their support to the regulator by voting for the mayor or whoever is in charge of this, whoever appoints the regulator. Right, so the regulator wants to please both groups, or rather is worried about pissing off both groups. If the regulator sets the price too low, well, that's going to make the firm angry, and there will be fewer campaign contributions and perks and so on. If the regulator sets the price too high, that's going to anger consumers who will, you know, who won't vote for the mayor, will vote for a new mayor that will kick out the regulator and put in a new regulator or whatever. So, in a sense, the regulator is trying to balance these different interests, is trying to play one group off another, or is trying to look at the trade-off between the support of one group and the support of another group. So that you can draw different kinds of diagrams to illustrate what these trade-offs might be, but we can explain it just with a, you know, in pretty simple logical fashion, something like the following, right? So how the regulator behaves in this price-setting example, if you like, depends on what, you know, economists call elasticities, right? It depends on the rate at which it can trade off one group's support for another, right? So what is the elasticity of profit, the thing that the firm cares about, with respect to price, the thing that the consumers care about? So higher electricity prices mean higher profits for the electric company. Lower prices mean more benefit utility for consumers. So, yeah, I mean, it's true that the regulator has to trade off support of one group against the support of the other, but it's helpful for the regulator to know, well, what is the rate at which I can trade off one for the other? And you can show with some, you know, depending on the conditions of producing electricity and so on, it might very well be the case that the profit for the firm is more sensitive to price changes when prices are low. I shouldn't say profits are low, when prices are low rather than high. And the point is, when the price that the regulated firm is charging to consumers is close to the sort of profit maximizing monopoly price, small changes in the price have a very small effect on profit, right? So the regulator, you know, starting from the profit maximizing monopoly price, could order the price to be lowered by, say, 10%, and then only reduces the monopolist profit by 1 or 2%. Okay, so changes in the price, when the price is already pretty high, have a modest impact on the firm's profits. However, when the price is very low, right, if the price is exactly equal to marginal cost, then the firm doesn't have any profit whatsoever. And allowing the price to be a little higher than marginal cost has a really substantial impact on the firm's profit. So the firm's profit is very sensitive to price when prices are low, and less sensitive to price when prices are high. Right? That suggests that the regulator is going to choose a regulated price that's ideal for the regulator, that's fairly close to the monopoly price, or rather closer to the monopoly price than to the very low price that's just equal to marginal cost. And it all depends on the particular conditions of production, relationship between fixed costs and variable costs, and so on. We could look at a number of different scenarios in which this trade-off might be reflected in different ways. But the point is that from the regulator's point of view, I want to think, well, how much, you know, how much support from consumers do I lose when I let the price go up a little bit? How much support from the industry do I gain when I let that price go up a little bit? And sort of think about these trade-offs at different sort of points along the potential pricing, potential price schedule, okay? Regulators can be very sophisticated in how they do this. right? They're trying to get the biggest bang for the buck in terms of managing this trade-off of political support between different groups. Right? One insight that we get from this is that, you know, regulators often behave in pretty complicated, difficult to understand ways. I mean, sometimes people say, well, regulation is either pro-consumer or pro-business. Yeah, but that's a highly oversimplified story, right? I mean, regulators' behavior is much more complex and subtle than that. It benefits some businesses at the expense of other businesses, and some consumers at the expense of other consumers, and these trade-offs can be very complicated, okay? The more general point is that political outcomes are highly sensitive to the relative effectiveness of special interests. When special interests can organize themselves, they are much more likely to get benefits in their interest than when they fail to organize. Okay, you know, some implications for managers of firms and for capitalist entrepreneurs who delegate authority to managers, right? Well, one is that, well, I mean, government regulation can be good for you as a firm if you can work the regulations in your favor, right? For example, government intervention, government regulation, is a major source of barriers to entry. If you've ever studied, you know, the Porter Five Forces model, tells you that, you know, entry barriers are very good for profitability. If you can keep other people out of your industry, you stand to benefit. Well, often, when it's difficult to do that on your own, you can try to get the state to do it for you. Right? It could be very directly by having laws that say certain people can't go into the industry. You know, you can't practice law without passing a state bar exam. So the government restricts the supply of lawyers to those who can pass certain tests. Well, if you're already a lawyer, you want there to be fewer new lawyers competing against you and bidding your prices down, bidding your wages down. You know, the post office has a legal, exclusive legal monopoly on the delivery of first-class mail. Regulation can often create entry barriers through less direct means as well. Right, like as we were talking about before with the Americans with Disabilities Act, or you know, restaurant health codes, or imposition of particular, you know, kinds of taxes that are easier for large firms to collect than small firms, maybe easier for incumbents than new entrants. So by imposing differential cost on potential newcomers, I can keep them out of my industry and earn higher profits. Okay, so the state is the great provider, great creator of entry barriers, not the free market, but rather the government. It suggests to managers and to their capitalist entrepreneurs that it can be very useful for businesses to form coalitions with other firms by forming trade associations, lobby groups, and so on, to offer support to politicians in exchange for particular benefits. You know, it says that businesses can often gain from participating in the political process. Was having a conversation. I was actually interviewed by a guy this morning for a video series on the moral foundations of capitalism. And we were discussing this very issue of what, as a manager or as an entrepreneur, one should do when operating, you know, in the mixed economy. You know, and I made the point, look, if I were a chief executive officer of a corporation with a fiduciary responsibility to my shareholders, to what extent would I be willing to partner with the state in ways that would make my shareholders better off? That's a very hard question to answer, right? I mean, I think from my own personal moral position, I would like to think, I'd say, well, I wouldn't be willing to do that. Okay? I think this government official is corrupt, and I think it's unfair. It's unjust that the state is going to, you know, impose costs on my competitors in a way that helps me. That's immoral, that's unjust, I wouldn't do it. At the same time, in my position as an agent for the shareholders, if I really thought that would put money in the shareholders' pockets, then maybe I have an obligation, a fiduciary responsibility, to partner with the state in that way. Okay? Now, I could argue that, well, yeah, but you know, there are always strings attached, and it really isn't good for shareholders in the long run to form this partnership with the state. But what if it were? What if I thought it were? What would I do under those circumstances? you know, there are milder cases too. A law professor at Northwestern named Fred McChesney has a great book called Shakedown that describes what he calls the rent extraction procedure, the rent extraction procedure that the government does. Essentially, he says, look, take an industry like software. Look at Microsoft, for example. Several people have noted that prior to the mid-90s, Microsoft did not employ a single lobbyist. Microsoft didn't even have an office in Washington, D.C. This was quite shocking to the political class and to, you know, people in more established industries who thought this was, you know, Microsoft's way of sort of thumbing its nose at Washington, D.C. and saying, we don't need you. We can do our own thing. Just leave us alone. Well, as you know, when the software industry was small, when Microsoft was a tiny startup company, they could get away with that attitude. But as Microsoft grew, became more influential, more economically powerful, more profitable, naturally politicians began to take notice. And he saw this series of antitrust investigations, you know, the huge antitrust case in the mid-90s against Microsoft that was eventually settled. You know, what happened as the government was hauling Microsoft into court on multiple occasions to defend itself? Microsoft set up a Washington, D.C. office and started hiring lobbyists and started making contributions to politicians' campaigns and so on. Now, you could either say, well, you know, Microsoft shouldn't have done that. It should have maintained its high ideals and should have thumbed its nose at politicians. Well, on the other hand, maybe that was all maybe Microsoft had to do that to survive, right? I mean, this kind of lobbying, it's basically a shakedown. That the one interpretation is that these antitrust cases were the government's way of saying to Microsoft, look, you either play ball or we will shut you down. You play by our rules, which means you pay us protection money in campaign contributions and so on, and we will allow you to survive. If you don't pay us this protection money, we'll shut you down. So it's basically like a mafia. It's like, you know, it's a protection racket, like something organized by the mafia. In a case like that, you could argue that, well, Microsoft is doing what it has to do to survive. Or rather, any business that plays the political game is doing what it has to do to survive in the mixed economy. That's a more sort of benevolent way of looking at what firms do when they play the political game. On the other hand, some of them are much more aggressive than that and are actively working the system to try to hurt their rivals. And that has, you know, a highly questionable ethical component to it. Fortunately, this isn't a course in ethics, so I don't have to dwell on that point very much. Now, there are a few issues that are specific to the corporate form, to corporations per se. And since I have corporation in the title of my lecture, I better say something about it. You know, there are tax issues that are specific to the corporation, the corporate form of organization compared to others. But the one issue that has come up time and time again, and that we touched on a little bit last week, is this whole issue of limited liability. Some economists and political theorists, many libertarian scholars, have argued that the corporation receives a special and unique privilege that is granted to it by the state, not by free market institutions, in the practice of limited liability. And that this is kind of an unfair advantage that the corporate form has over partnerships and proprietorships and cooperatives and so on. That if it weren't for the state privilege of limited liability, the corporate form of organization would have never taken off. We would have far fewer corporations, maybe no corporations whatsoever. That the only reason the corporate form is the dominant form of organization for large enterprises today is because of this artificial state privilege. My view is that, limited liability grants by the state are, of course, a form of privilege, but it's not at all clear that this is very different from the kind of limited liability practices that have historically emerged and would presumably exist even if there were no state. Even if there were no state intervention in the economy. I mean, it's true as a historical matter that the practice of limited liability in various forms predates the state, sort of official state formalization of limited liability. But even holding that aside, it's important to emphasize, as I mentioned last week, that limited liability means at least two different things, right? There's limited liability in the creditor sense and limited liability in the tort sense. In the creditor sense, this simply means by forming a corporation, when members of the corporation go to raise capital, they negotiate with capital providers, either lenders, bondholders, or equity holders, that the shareholders are only liable for financial obligations up to the amount of money they invested in the firm. Okay, so if the firm goes bankrupt, the firm's creditors, the banks, you know, vendors, whatever, can recover only as much money as shareholders have put into the corporation. But these creditors cannot go after the personal assets of the shareholders. Okay, as we discussed last week, I mean, this is a purely ethically neutral or politically neutral issue that would be negotiated in a free market between borrowers and lenders. Right, so you know, I can form I myself as an individual, I can go to the bank and I can say, look, I want to borrow money. I want the contract to say that if I can't pay the money back, you can't take my house and my car and my kids' college savings accounts. Okay, maybe the bank would say, no, sorry, you don't have enough collateral. We're not willing to do that unless you put up your house and your car and your kid as collateral. Sorry, your kid's savings account as collateral. So maybe I can't get a loan. And I have to go to another bank and see if I can find somebody who's willing to make me a loan under those terms. And maybe eventually I find somebody, but because they don't like the terms, they charge me a very high interest rate. Right? Somebody else, another business person, sets up a firm and goes to borrow money and says, hey, you know, I'll put my house on the line. I'll put my children on the line. And if I go bust, you can take it all. Well, presumably that entrepreneur is going to find it easier to obtain credit than the entrepreneur in the first case. We'll get more loans and, you know, have a lower interest rate and so on. Fine. I mean, that's up to borrowers and lenders. They can work all this out. Notice it has nothing to do with the corporation per se. I mean, the fact that now you have a group of entrepreneurs who pool their resources, by establishing a joint stock company and say to the bank, hey, we're only liable up to a certain amount. Okay, it's the exact same problem. Some corporations might say, yeah, you can go after our assets, personal assets, and some would say, no, you can't, and, you know, the former group would pay a higher interest rate than the latter. Fine. I mean, this can all be worked out on private capital markets. There's no special legal privilege being granted to anybody in a case like that. Liability would either be limited or unlimited in this creditor sense, depending on the terms of the debt relationship. The more complicated issue is limited liability for person and property damage for torts, right? And the argument that some libertarian critics of the corporation have made is that corporations get away with murder, right? Because the state says if BP puts oil into the ocean and it damages your property, you can only sue up to a certain amount. You can recover some damages for BP, but if the company's broke, then you're out of luck, right? You cannot sue the shareholders and make them, as individuals, pay for your cleanup. And people say, well, that's unfair, right? That's an artificial privilege that's granted by the state. Only corporations have this privilege, and therefore corporations have an unfair advantage in the mixed economy because the state gives them this limits their liability against torts. I think this is a specious argument, right? Because it assumes that in the absence of state grants of limited liability against torts, there would be unlimited liability for shareholders. And it's not at all clear that that would happen under some alternative, you know, legal institutions, the free market courts or whatever, would impose those kind of rules. And again, I think it helps to see this by you know, abstracting away from the legal form of organization. Right? The exact same issues arise even with a sole proprietorship. Okay? Imagine that I'm not a corporation, but I'm the owner of my own mom and pop store, and I hire, I think I used this example last time, I hire Grayson or Dan, one of the TAs, you know, to drive a delivery truck for me, and Grayson and drives the truck in a reckless manner, and he smashes into you and he damages your car. And you want to be, you don't have any insurance or whatever, and you want the company to pay for your damages. Okay, well, if the company's broke, if the company doesn't have enough money, then you're out of luck, right? Now, would you necessarily be able to go after my personal assets to cover the damage to your property? Well, maybe not. I mean, it's not at all clear that the employer, that the owner of the sole proprietorship should be liable for all torts committed by its employees, right? In fact, under Anglo-Saxon law, there are many cases in which the employer is not responsible, right? It depends on whether the agent, the truck driver in this case, was acting consistent with the duties as given by the employer, right? So if Grayson is driving recklessly when my instructions to him were to drive safely, then I would typically not be found liable for torts for damage to person or property committed by the driver. In other words, it has nothing to do with me being a corporation, right? So saying that the corporate shareholders are not legally liable for torts committed by employees is really the same issue. I mean, these critics assume that in the absence of state limited liability grants, shareholders would in fact be liable for torts committed by corporate employees, but I don't see why they would. Some cases where they might be considered responsible, other cases where they wouldn't. And I imagine that sort of libertarian common law courts would work this out in a way that looks very much like the limited liability that we have today. So I think what the state is doing, I mean, I agree that it would be better if limited liability, if liability issues both for debts and for torts could be worked out by market participants on their own. Nonetheless, I don't think empirically the state grants of limited liability are making a huge difference. I just don't think they have much of an impact on the scale and scope of the corporate sector as we have it today. Now, more generally, is the issue that comes up in the exchange between Roderick Long and myself. You know, does state intervention systematically favor large firms over small firms? Roderick gives some reasons why he thinks that state intervention does, and I give some counterarguments why I think that it doesn't. You know, to make a long story short, I think there's a whole set of government interventions that give advantages to big firms. You know, some of them listed here on the slide. But there are a whole lot of interventions that favor small firms. I'm sorry, there's a typographical error on the slide here. The green bullet point, direct subsidies, that should be indented at one more level. I'll send out a corrected version. That should be a sub point under interventions that favor small firms. Just to highlight one example, Roderick relies heavily on the work of Kevin Carson, who has argued persuasively that government subsidies for long distance transportation, rail and road in particular, give an advantage to firms that want to produce on a very large scale. Okay, so heavily concentrated production in big factories benefits greatly from subsidized transportation to move inputs and outputs, you know, from to and from the central location. And so Kevin Carson argues in the absence of state subsidies for transportation, we would have, you know, many more smaller decentralized firms, co-ops and so on, cottage production. I think what Kevin leaves out of his argument is the role that subsidized communication costs, subsidized communication plays in making cottage production feasible, right? So you don't have to get, you know, think of the so-called slow food movement, right? You know, eating locally grown foods and all that. You don't need to ship in the food by truck from, you know, where these huge cornfields in Iowa, if you grow your own corn or go corn in the neighborhood co-op. That's true, but you still need to have the knowledge of how to grow corn. You need to have information about prices to be able to perform economic calculation in Mises's sense, and for that you need information, and no doubt the state subsidy for communications, radio, television, telephone, internet, and so on, provides an advantage to cottage production that it wouldn't otherwise have. You know, the point is, how do all these things balance out? Well, who knows? if we eliminated all government intervention in the economy today, what would the economy look like? Roderick and Kevin Carson think, oh, there's no doubt that we would have, firms would be much smaller and much flatter, much less hierarchical than they are today. I don't see that at all. It's equally likely that if we eliminated all government intervention in the economy, we would have, on average, larger firms, maybe more hierarchical firms than we have today. This is a purely empirical question that a priori economic theory doesn't answer for us. The only way to find out is to let the market process sort itself out. And here's where I think Roderick and I people like Kevin Carson would agree, okay, let's remove these artificial, remove these state interventions and see what happens. But Roderick and Kevin and I have different predictions about what presumably would happen in that case. Okay, I've spoken for much longer than I wanted to, which, yeah, I know, I do it every time. Let me go back to the chat room for a moment. In fact, I'm going to start by unsharing my screen. That way I can see things a little bit better here. Okay, now because I'm on my laptop where I just have a single monitor, I have not been able to follow the discussion in the chat room as it's been going, so I'm just going to scroll up a little bit and see some of the comments that you guys have written and see if there's anything in particular that I ought to respond to. Okay, a lot of this is highly humorous, yet somewhat idle chatter, so I'm not going to address everything that you guys have said because I can't keep up with your with your humor. Let's see. So if there's any serious points here. I mean, sorry, I don't... That came out wrong. You guys are all making serious points. Let me see if there's something specific that I ought to respond to right here. Wow, the humor is just going by fast and furious today. Well, what the hell? Okay, let's just start over here. does anyone have any specific issues or questions that you would like me to respond to now? I know we've kind of run over our... we've already... Well, sorry, we still have some discussion time left, but I lectured for longer than I wanted to. But go ahead and type a question in now or shoot me a question on email if you want me to cover it. We have about 20 minutes left before we're supposed to sign off. Here's a question from Dean, who usually asks serious questions. I shouldn't have said that. Okay, given the backward nature of telephone communication in the U.S., not clear that government on net encourages more or cheaper communication. Dean, I agree with you. Maybe that isn't the best example. I'm simply saying that the picture is a lot murkier, and you're agreeing with me here. It's a lot murkier trying to sort out. I mean, look, think about it. Try to think of any aspect of your daily life, whether we're talking about your commercial life, more narrowly construed, or just your day-to-day life as a consumer, that isn't touched in some way by government intervention in the economy. I mean, there are hundreds, indeed thousands, of interventions that affect everything that you do on a daily basis. If you took all those away, what would the, you know, what would the result be? I mean, if we had no government intervention whatsoever, would I eat more ice cream or less ice cream than I eat now? You say, well, the price of ice cream is higher than it would be because of dairy subsidies, but then it's lower than it would be because of transportation, public roads, and who knows? I mean, it's just so complicated. I think it's something that it's very difficult to make any predictions about ex ante. Now, to be fair, the point that Roderick and his associates are making is a perfectly valid point, that as libertarians, right, free market economists, should not be eager to assume that everything that corporations do is great, and that, you know, big firms are better than small firms because they're more industrial and capitalistic somehow, right? This has been a common criticism of Ayn Rand's fiction, and some of her nonfiction writings as well, that she sort of overly romanticizes the large business person. That, in other words, she looks only at the sort of heroic free market aspects of capitalist entrepreneurs, while downplaying or ignoring the fact that, historically speaking, many, many important industrialists have also been beneficiaries, directly or indirectly, of state intervention. That, you know, under sort of political capitalism, a success as an industrialist may be just as much a function of who you know in Washington, D.C. or Brussels or wherever than your actual skill as an entrepreneur. I mean, that's all completely true. I think we should grant Roderick and his associates, give them credit for pointing out that Rand is being a little bit naive here, right? That clearly all big business people are not heroes. They may be evil and corrupt, and they may be beneficiaries of the welfare state more than anybody else, right? But it doesn't follow from that that the large firm per se is somehow intrinsically inefficient and has survived only because it alone is a beneficiary of the state. And that's one reason I asked you to read the little blog post on what my colleague Mike Cook has called vaguely defined or ill-defined property rights. Because I think in some of the literature, in what's sometimes called the mutualist movement, associated with people like Kevin Carson and Roderick and so on, is a very effective and systematic discussion of the various inefficiencies that large firms in general and corporations in particular are susceptible to. You know, principal agent problem, the Burleian means problem that we talked about before, various kinds of bureaucratic inefficiency, managerial incompetence. I mean, it's no doubt large firms do suffer from a number of efficiency problems along these lines. But my point in that blog post is that all forms of organization are inefficient relative to some textbook ideal. Even cooperatives, small mom-and-pop shops, you know, worker-owned mutual associations and so on, they also are subject to a range of economic efficiencies related to the specific problems discussed in that blog post, horizon issues, portfolio issues, and so on. All forms of organization are flawed, and merely pointing out the defects of one does not constitute a defense of another. Right, we're always weighing or comparing various kinds of imperfect alternatives, and it's not at all. I guess I would say that the mutualist community, in my sense, sort of romanticizes the co-op in the same way that Ayn Rand maybe romanticizes, you know, the steel tycoon. Dan asked for recommendations on the history of government regulations. Wow, that is a great question. I want to think about that a little bit before I answer. I mean, a number of good books come to mind. Some of Robert Higgs's writings, his book Crisis and Leviathan, is a fantastic work, but it covers much more just than business regulation per se. There's a business historian at Harvard University named Thomas McCraw. It's McCraw, not McGraw with a G, but McCraw with a C. His best-known book is a recent biography of Joseph Schumpeter, but back in the 80s, he wrote an excellent book called Profits of Regulation. Profits, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Profits of Regulation, profiling some of the most important 20th century, 19th and 20th century business regulators. And it provides a very good history of business regulation in the U.S. But again, let me think about that a little bit more, Dan, because there's probably a lot of other good works out there that are not coming to mind at the moment. Please post that question in the forum, and so not only I, but others of you can respond to that as well with reading suggestions. Let's see. Grayson, did Mises have a position on limited liability? Not to my knowledge. Mises talks a little bit about the corporate form in socialism of all places, and there's some great discussion of modern organizational economics, principal agent problems, so-called adverse selection problems in Mises' 1922 book Socialism, but I don't recall him taking discussing the specific institution of limited liability, but I'd have to go back and double check. Robert, do I have an opinion on the size of the state that would be more effective? Would that be related to your thoughts on the size of the firm? Yeah, it's a very good question. A few people have written about application of modern organizational economics to the state, right? So can we think about sort of the optimal boundaries of the state using the same kind of reasoning that we used to talk about the optimal boundaries of the firm? That's a really difficult question for the main reason that while you can see the analogy between, you know, transaction cost or property rights arguments about the firm and how they might apply to the state, you know, there are obvious important differences, right? Namely, that the state has the power of coercion, that the state produces outputs that are not bought and sold on markets, that state officials cannot perform economic calculation in the same way that private, that capitalist entrepreneurs can. There's no selection mechanism for state functionaries that works, you know, the analogous to that of the selection mechanism of profit and loss. So the analogy doesn't hold. It only, you know, it's pretty limited. I would suggest, Robert, looking at Mises' book Bureaucracy, and especially his discussion, I think it's chapter 3, but I have to double check, on what he called, there's two chapters, maybe it's 3 and 4, on profit management versus what he calls bureaucratic management. So Mises' discussion of bureaucratic management is, in a sense, an attempt to apply economic principles to what Mises saw as kind of the correct functioning of the state. I mean, as I'm sure most of you guys know, Mises was not a so-called anarcho-capitalist. Mises was kind of a limited government classical liberal. He did think the state was legitimate, and that some degree of intervention in the economy by the state could be justified on economic grounds. Hayek, of course, went much further than Mises in arguing for justifying particular interventions in the state, where Rothbard is at the other extreme, arguing against even the interventions that Mises would have supported. But Mises, you know, he didn't just arbitrarily say, well, the state ought to do X, Y, Z. I mean, he had some sophisticated arguments, which you may accept or reject, on how the state should operate and how the state should function, that he spelled out in some detail in his book Bureaucracy. But Robert, that's a place that I would look. As asking a question about China, I think that's right, that in a sense, I mean, the funny thing about China is that, you know, nominally on the surface, of course, it's still a one-party communist state, but many reports on the ground suggest that in practice, China is pretty laissez-faire, especially the farther away you get from the capital, right, that in rural communities and small towns in the distant provinces, the de facto regulation of business is much smaller than, you know, the ostensible official kinds of regulations of business. So it may be the case that there's a lot more economic freedom in China than in many parts of the Western world. So I think that's a very provocative point, and I think you're probably right. Grayson is trying to ask me some complicated question about limited liability that has the word catalactic in it. So, sorry, dude, you're out of luck. I like to go for the low-hanging fruit first. Let me look at some other questions first, and then I'll come back to your question, Grayson, if we have time. Michael is asking about common law versus sort of you know, positive law, legislation. By the way, the background here is, you know, sort of the more general Austrian theory about institutions. Hayek wrote a lot in favor of the common law as opposed to statutory law or legislation. Also, the Italian scholar Bruno Leoni, L-E-O-N-I, wrote a little book called Freedom and the Law that is very good on this distinction between law and legislation. Leoni specifically brings in the analogy with socialism, the free market. And people have said that, well, common law rules, because they're they kind of evolve bottom up. They're more decentralized. It's kind of more like the market, where statutory rules are more like central planning, sort of you know, designed from the top down. The question is, Michael's question, does the Austrian tradition argue in favor of common law arrangements for things like you know, corporate charters and so on? I mean, Michael, that's not really an Austrian issue per se, but I think that libertarian legal theorists have, of course, been much more sympathetic to common law type solutions than to legislated top-down solutions. But I mean, you'd have to look at the Austrian legal literature to get some more insight and more details in that. But yeah, I think basically you're right, although that's not really a part of Austrian economic theory per se, but more kind of libertarian political economy more broadly. There's a good discussion here between Daniel and Dean about intellectual property, and I'm just going to, I think, I don't have much to add to that. I mean, I will make a small point about the internet. You know, I mean, it's true that, of course, the early development of the internet was very heavily subsidized by the state, right? Not only the direct subsidies from the Defense Department, you know, the underlying technology of the internet protocol and so on, TCP/IP. You know, this was not designed on the free market, but was designed by DARPA in conjunction with some research universities and so on, using federal dollars. So clearly the underlying architecture of the internet owes its origin to state intervention. Now, does that mean that that, you know, the internet technology that we have now is sort of an artificial product of the state? Well, I mean, in one sense, clearly not, right? I mean, the commercial internet is, you know, has many wonderful laissez-faire free market aspects to it, and clearly the government funders back in the 1960s, you know, didn't envision anything like the commercial internet that we have today. So, does, you know, you hear people like Al Gore saying, you know, this is many economists saying, you know, this is an example of where the government did something right. You know, isn't it a good thing that government resources were used to subsidize the R&D and to build the labs and so on that did the work that led to the internet? If it hadn't been for DARPA and it hadn't been for certain universities that federal dollars, we wouldn't have the internet. Well, I mean, look, we got to be very careful to avoid, you know, Hazlitt's broken window fallacy, building on Bastiat, right? I mean, it's true that if we hadn't had DARPA and those particular federally funded research grants in the 1960s, we wouldn't have exactly the internet that we have today, but that doesn't mean we wouldn't have a high-speed communications network. We would just have a different one, or maybe it would be different. Maybe it would use a different underlying architecture. Maybe it wouldn't be based on TCP/IP. It would be based on something else. But, you know, maybe it would be even better. It would be more efficient, more effective, even more fantastic than the internet that we have now. So the fact that the internet's great and that we love it and that, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation now if it weren't for the internet, it doesn't follow from that. That is not a justification for the particular government interventions that established kind of the early internet protocols and so on. That's just like, you know, looking at the new pane of glass in Bastiat's example and saying if it hadn't been for the hoodlum who threw the brick, we wouldn't have this wonderful pane of glass. Yeah, but we'd have a lot of other stuff, okay? And the market presumably would have created some kind of high-speed communications network, even in the absence of state subsidies for internet development and high-speed telecom and so on. We don't know exactly what it would look like, right? But that's no argument in favor of the government doing the kinds of things that it did to create what we have today. Yeah, there's some great discussion on China here. Getting a little asynchronous here in the chat thread, and that's fine. You know, besides China and the fact that there is a lot of, you know, free market activity going on in places like China, you know, a related issue is that you know, regulatory regimes are very heterogeneous and complex, and oftentimes we want to have kind of like one number and say, well, if we could take all the different countries and put them on a single scale and say which one is more socialist and which one is more capitalist, can we assign a number to each country? Well, that's pretty hard to do because different countries intervene in different ways. You know, just to use a very simple example, most people think that the Scandinavian countries are much more socialistic than the U.S. or the U.K. or Hong Kong or something like that. We say, well, you know, Sweden and Norway and Denmark, they have the big welfare states. And actually, you know, critics of capitalism, critics of the market will say, look, those countries have very high standards of living. So Sweden and Denmark and Norway are a lot more socialist than the U.S., but they have a very high standard of living, by some measures higher standard of living than the U.S. Doesn't that prove that socialism is a good thing, or at least that having a socialist economy doesn't harm, you know, doesn't harm business, doesn't harm GDP? So what's the big deal? Right, if we actually look at the Scandinavian countries, I mean, they do have very big welfare states in terms of providing health and retirement benefits and so on. They have very high personal income tax rates. But in many ways, their economies are less regulated than the U.S. economy. To use Denmark, for example, a country that I know well, having spent a lot of time there, Denmark taxes the heck out of your personal income, but Denmark doesn't have any corporate income taxes. And in many industries, it's much more laissez-faire than the U.S. So you have a relatively free economy with very high personal income tax rates and lots of government services, you know, socialized medicines and so on. On balance, is that more or less socialist than the U.S.? Well, we don't have socialized medicine. We don't have it yet. Our personal income tax rates are lower. Our welfare benefits are lower, but our industries are more heavily regulated. Which one's more socialist? Well, I don't know. It depends how you measure. So my sense is the reason the Scandinavian countries have done very well despite the welfare state aspects, because their economies, their industrial economies, are very, very strong because they're relatively laissez-faire on that dimension. So it's a complex, multi-dimensional problem that can't easily be, you know, summarized in a single number. I usually make the Tang and Velcro jokes as well. Great example of broken window fallacy, although I've been told when I've used those examples before that even those aren't true, that NASA really didn't invent Tang, NASA really didn't invent Velcro, but just took some inventions that were already been developed in the private sector. But even if NASA did bring us Tang and Velcro and microwave ovens and all that, that wouldn't be sufficient as a defense of NASA, because you have to think of the opportunity cost, right? The huge, vast amounts of resources that were consumed by NASA, excuse me, that would otherwise have been put into productive use developing all kinds of new technologies. Maybe we'd have an even a better tasting orange drink than Tang if the government hadn't created Tang through NASA, assuming that it did. Okay, it's about 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, so time to wrap it up. As I said, we'll have our regularly scheduled office hours on Thursday. We'll lecture at our regular time next week, so not a half hour later, but our regular time of 6 o'clock Eastern. On next Tuesday. I'm not sure whether or not we'll have office hours a week from Thursday. We'll kind of play that by ear. But sometime next week, we'll also have another exam. Right? We had a fun midterm exam. We'll also have a fun final exam, at the end of which final grades will be compiled and distributed. So the format of the final exam will be similar to the format of the midterm exam. You know, similar kinds of questions, the same delivery technology. The questions may be a little bit more general and more comprehensive, in a sense, than the questions we had on the midterm. So final exam questions will not only cover the material that's new since the midterm, but also review some of the material that we covered before the midterm. But again, we'll have plenty of time next week during the lecture period, and then during the office hours of next week, if we have them, for me to answer any questions that you guys have about anything that we've talked about. And right, what I want you to begin thinking about is not only learning the specific ideas and theories and applications week to week, but to try to think a little bit more about, you know, putting it all together, synthesizing and integrating. Right, at the end of the day, what does all this mean? Right, what are kind of the big picture questions that we've addressed in the course? How do different concepts work together? How do they affect each other? What are kind of the general lessons that we can take away from this 10 or 12 week experience or 9 week experience, whatever it's been? To me, it seems like hundreds of weeks. I didn't say that. From this experience that we've had, what have we learned kind of at the end of the day? So that's the kind of stuff I want you to begin thinking about, and things that we'll talk about during our discussion next week in office hours and so on. So good night, everybody. Look forward to talking to you on Thursday. Feel free to send me an email or give me a call, and let's keep all these discussions going in the forums. Bye-bye.